Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 28, Christmas Pudding with Arsenic Sauce. David Marshall was a man without a natural constituency. He was a member of one of, if not the smallest community in Singapore, the Jewish community. They were barely a few hundred in 1955, barely a blip among the 1 million residents of Singapore. But Marshall was able to build himself a constituency by virtue of the simple fact that he unconditionally stood up for Singapore's working classes, the downtrodden, the disenfranchised. In the past episode, we discussed how he was able to rally the support of the working class behind him by winning concessions from the British and by initiating laws that ended open discrimination, including laws ensuring multilingualism in the Legislative Assembly, enfranchisement via an equitable form of citizenship, workers' rights, free legal aid for the poor, and the kickstarting of the Malayanization of the civil service. He improved the economy and increased trade. He gave people hope by standing up to the British and showing that there was another way forward, one in which local politicians did not have to kneel and cower and collude and be friendly with the British authorities, with the colonial authorities, with the imperial authorities, but could openly defy them and stand before them as an equal and face them down. He established patterns of behaviour for his office, a praxis of honesty, of service to the public, of liberalism, that would set the pattern for the office for decades afterwards. Thus, by the end of 1955, Marshall's popularity was at an all-time high. 5 months and 7 days later, he resigned. What happened? The perils of Marshall's approach began to be clear as the calendar turned to 1956. First, Marshall's breakneck pace was simply unsustainable. He was exhausted, overworked, and had no talent in his own cabinet that he could work with. If you think about the talent that the PAP drew together, Devan Nair, Lim Chin Siong, Samad Ismail, Rajaratnam, Goh Keng Swee, Toh Chin Chye, Ong Pang Boon, Wood Hal, James Puthucheary, and of course Lee Kuan Yew himself. And then Kwa Geok Chu, Chan Choy Siong, you know, an incredible collection of some of the most brilliant men and women this country has ever produced working together. David Marshall, he had no one else of genuine talent to work with. Which is not to say that some of them were not good people. Francis Thomas, for example, was a very, very good man. But really, in terms of ability, Marshall stood alone in the Labour Front. And so it's no surprise from his constant overwork due to his long hours that he collapsed from exhaustion on 17 January 1956 and was ordered to rest. But David just could not, did not want to do so. And so he kept being ill on and off for the next 2 months. Finally, his doctors ordered him to take a vacation. He went off to Switzerland, but stayed in constant communication with his colleagues. And indeed, Governor Black was terribly worried while David was away and kept asking him to come back as soon as possible. He felt that Marshall stood, quote, so much head and shoulders above the other members of the government, unquote, and worried about what might happen when Marshall and Lim Yew Hock, the only experienced politician in government, were both simultaneously away, for example, during the London constitutional talks in April. Second, Marshall had pushed the British as far as they could go. Marshall had won concession after concession, but by August 1955, the British cabinet outright refused to allow the Secretary of State for the Colonies, Alan Lennox Boyd, to make any further constitutional changes. Marshall, however, was keen to keep up the momentum. He was fired by a sense of justice. He wanted more because it was Singaporeans' right. But the fact that was that the British wanted a reliable local collaborator, someone who would identify British interests as their own. And Marshall was anything but that. At the very least, the British were simply panicked. They were just moving too fast. They wanted to slow down. Third, Marshall had built his constituency. He had put it together very quickly, but it was another question whether he could keep it. The Labour Front was a coalition of men with common interests, but they had no real party apparatus, no organisation, no administration. Marshall had to slowly build one from scratch after they won power, and he struggled with the internal politics of the situation. Everyone in the party believed that they should be the one in charge. At the Labour Front AGM in October 1955, David announced he would not stand for re-election as president. Again, here, Marshall was trying to do the right thing, to build up a party that was bigger than him, by giving away power. Can you see any of our other political leaders ever doing something like that? Unfortunately, what happened next was a disaster. Through no fault of David's, but a disaster nonetheless. Assemblyman A.R. Lazarus attempted to steal the election by packing the meeting with his supporters, who weren't actually members of the party. When Lazarus won the election for party president by a suspiciously huge margin, the other members demanded a check of everyone's credentials. Lazarus' supporters promptly fled for the exits. After a re-vote, Lim Yew Hock was elected president. But then Lazarus, C.H. Koh and Lee Chun Eng then resigned, the three assemblymen taking half the party membership with them. This left the Labour Front with only 8 seats in the Assembly of 25. Its coalition with UMNO MCA gave it 3 more seats. So it needed the votes of 2 nominated members, Francis Thomas and Richard Lim, to pass legislation. Hardly an ideal situation. So we think of the infamous PAP splits of 1961 and 62 as being something unique. Actually, it was very typical of political parties in Singapore's fledgling democracy, and especially of the two broad-based parties of the left. The Labour Party in 1951 split 4 ways. The Labour Front in 1955 split into 2. The Workers' Party split in 1958. Singapore UMNO also split in 1958 with members of its left wing joining the PAP. And it's no surprise then that the PAP in 61 and 62 would also split into 2. We don't need to look for conspiracy, it's just honest disagreement, it's conflict, or a lack of party discipline, or it may even be a greed for power. It's too many chiefs, not enough Native Americans. Too many queens, not enough bees. Too many Buffys, not enough Xanders. Anyway, without a coherent party organization, Marshall could not lead and rally his supporters for political change, especially in a period where widespread public pressure was necessary to effect change. As we've discussed, this was the period of associational democracy, when genuine change required mass movements, overwhelming public power to force the colonial government to shift policy. It required us to rip change from unwilling British hands. And Marshall's successors, for all his success, they were just changes at the margins. The Attorney General, the Financial Secretary and the Colonial Secretary were all British officials, and between them they controlled the law, the money and the police. Without these key portfolios, Marshall was severely limited. The Constitution limited him. The Governor had the final say. So it would need sustained public political pressure to effect genuine change, and Marshall didn't have the organisation for it. Only one group had that kind of power in Singapore, and that was the Middle Road Group of Unions led by Lim Chin Siong. Which is why, over the next 2 years, the Americans would unsuccessfully expend huge efforts to build up Lim Yew Hock's STUC, Singapore Trades Union Congress, as a rival, believing, of course, that the Middle Road Group of Unions was sympathetic to the communists at the very least. And it also explains why, in late 1956, the British would move to destroy the Middle Road Group. But more about that next week. This week, suffice to note that Marshall was not able to build up a popular movement, a popular organization to back up his agenda. So he had no natural base, he was overworked, he didn't have the time, he was undermined by his colleagues and their agendas, he just wasn't able to do it in the short time that he had. And finally, his own personality made it difficult. By the end of 1955, the public had a much more realistic assessment of Marshall. Parts of his personality which had seemed first so refreshing, you know, his brutal honesty, his soaring rhetoric and his temper, now grated. He was never going to be able to fulfill all that people desired of him. I mean, think of how much Barack Obama disappointed people after his 2008 election, because people read into Obama what they wanted, not necessarily what was actually promised. And same with Marshall. He inspired so much, people saw what they wanted to see in him. But Marshall also had flaws, and his flaws were particularly on display on his trip to London in December 1955, for preliminary talks with Alan Lennox Boyd. He made a number of public criticisms of the Bank of England and the Colonial Office, and back in Singapore was criticised himself for making too many public statements and getting himself in trouble and embarrassing the country. The Nanyang Shangbao suggested that he was better off keeping his head down and getting on with negotiations. In general, Marshall was an activist, a man of principle, a man of bombastic flair. He spoke from the heart. He was unwilling to make compromises on points of principle, and he was reluctant to engage in the patient deal-making that is required in democracy. Nor, of course, was he willing to seize and control power to ensure that he could impose his will on a reluctant party or country. He was that rarest of creatures, a genuine Democrat. But he was exhausted, he was alone, he was being undermined by his colleagues. And all these problems would come to a head and be laid bare in the 1956 constitutional talks in London. And we'll talk about that when we return. In January 1956, the Federation of Malaya won the promise of a firm date of independence, 31st August 1957, from the British, as well as immediate internal self-government. Although the Federation had no elected legislature before July 1955, some 7 years after Singapore, it achieved a date for independence just 7 months after its first general election. This gave hope to Singapore that it would also quickly achieve independence. Marshall organized a petition and a public rally in Singapore in an attempt to demonstrate the depth of public feeling. There was tremendous excitement for the rally in the Chinese press, which hoped that it would demonstrate the, quote, fierce longing for independence, unquote, among the people. There was a massive turnout, but the rally went poorly. Difficulties with the amplifying equipment were followed by the collapse of the main platform as Marshall was speaking. Pandemonium erupted and clashes broke out. A group of visiting British MPs had to be quickly ferried away to safety. Some blamed the failure of the rally on people trying to sabotage and discredit the anti-colonial movement to, quote, give colonialists an excuse to exaggerate and play up the incident for no other purpose than to frustrate the claim of the people of Singapore for independence, unquote. But others, focusing on the depths of emotion on display, called the rally a success and attributed the incidents to a lack of experience. They attacked the Straits Times for exaggerating the scale of the incident, making a mountain out of a molehill, and, quote, giving London the impression that Singapore was not ready for independence, unquote. The Nanyang Shangbao condemned those who tried to blame the incident on students, pointing out that the police had found no evidence of mischief or organized sabotage. The students themselves put out a statement condemning the disturbance. Even the Chongqing Jitbao, usually quick to blame everything on communist activity, noted that it had been well established by Special Branch that the Malayan Communist Party supported the independence movement and wanted an independent Malaya. They were therefore unlikely to have sabotaged the rally. But the incident was quickly overtaken by a greater worry: the lack of unity among the members of the all-party delegation. The divisions among the delegates had been regularly reported. For example, the Liberal Socialist Party, which was formed from a merger of the Democrat and Progressive parties, wanted the British to maintain control of internal security. But Marshall and the PAP wanted complete local control. Singapore UMNO, worried about the dilution of their vote, objected to Marshall's proposals to enfranchise Singapore's China-born Chinese who had been resident for more than 15 years. As the date of the talks drew near, frustration with the political fighting among the parties grew. With so much at stake, it was absolutely necessary for the parties to present a solid front to Lennox Boyd. The Chongqing Jitbao noted that the delegation's advisor on constitutional law, Sir Ivor Jennings, had included an important caveat in his advice. Success was predicated on unity in the delegation, and the Chongqing Jitbao quietly doubted that this would occur. Before departure, Marshall tabled a motion in the Legislative Assembly, asking the Assembly to approve his negotiating position for the talks. Despite a stormy, contentious debate, it was unanimously approved. The Chinese press having approved of Marshall's stance, greeted the vote with the hope that divisions would be temporarily set aside for the duration of the talks. And the Nanyang Changpao's editorial also thanked Marshall personally for his support of the Chinese and defending their rights. They wrote, quote, "We Chinese are profoundly grateful to Mr. Marshall for speaking justice in this way on our behalf. For many years, the Chinese in Singapore and the Federation have unceasingly suffered defamation, humiliation, exclusion, and persecution. Now, Mr. Marshall, a Jew, has aired our grievances, which have for many years remained suppressed in our hearts. This is 100 times more effective than if it were to come from our own mouths." Unquote. Their optimism was sadly short-lived. At the pre-departure press conference, one of the Liberal Socialist Party representatives interrupted Marshall as he was speaking and argued with him about the point he was making. The delegation's splits were being laid bare in front of the press. "It seemed," said the Hsinchu Jitpo sadly, "that independence was more about, quote, the aggrandizement of glory and interests of certain sections of the people to the neglect of the interests of the other sections." Unquote. Lennox Boyd, meanwhile, had decided that Singapore's strategic importance, combined with the serious security threat and the unstable political situation, made it impossible for Britain to make any future concessions. This would likely lead to Marshall's resignation and the reimposition of direct rule. To soften the impact of such a drastic step, Lennox Boyd aimed to clearly demonstrate to everyone, to the world, that he had negotiated with reason and good faith. So his goal really was to gently run the constitutional talks into the ground, taking as long as it needed to go nowhere, conceding only the symbolic, but ensuring that power remained ultimately in British hands. At the conference, the Singapore delegation submitted their proposals calling for the colony to be granted full sovereign independence. Britain's diplomatic representative would retain reserve powers over defence and external relations. But Lennox Boyd insisted on control over internal security, pointing out that the Labour Front government had not given cause for great confidence in that regard. He proposed a Defence and Security Council chaired by the UK High Commissioner, with elected ministers and military and police representatives to retain control of internal security. Marshall insisted on both independence and control of internal security and was backed by the vernacular press in Singapore. The Chongqing Jitpao accused the British of hypocrisy, using the communist threat to deny Singapore independence while recognizing the People's Republic of China to protect its own commercial interests. Marshall, it argued, understood the local communist menace far better than the British colonial government ever did, and his moderate actions had gone further to defeating communist subversion than the colonial government's heavy-handed actions. It concluded, quote, "If Britain is reluctant to grant independence and freedom to Singapore on this excuse, it would show that she has no intention to give up the already outdated colonial rule." Unquote. The Nanfang Evening Post added, "What self-government is there if it has no control over internal security?" Marshall already told his delegations that, quote, "We prefer to return empty-handed than to bring back half a loaf of bread." Unquote. His firm stand is praiseworthy. The people of Singapore would support his firm stand. Unquote. But there were those willing to accept less. A significant minority of commentary in letters to the press expressed the opinion that if independence was not forthcoming, then they should take what they could. Independence was inevitable, so this was just a temporary setback. The Nanyang Changpao, for example, argued that, quote, "If we could come back first with the rights of internal self-government, other comparatively difficult problems can be decided later. There is no need to force an issue now." Unquote. The lack of unity in the delegation continued to be a source of frustration. Midway through the talks, Liberal Socialist Party leader C.C. Tan was condemned in the Chinese press for his, quote, "self-serving and faithless politicking," unquote, when he criticised the Marshall government and said that the Liberal Socialist Party stood ready to form a government if the Labour Front government fell. Lee Kuan Yew was also roundly criticised for making a statement in London attacking Marshall's leadership, declaring that, quote, "Asia is for the Asians. Marshall is not an Asian, so he must not hold the power of government," unquote. His statement was inaccurate. As we know from our previous two episodes, Marshall was born in Singapore and his family were from Baghdad. But more importantly, it was racist. So Marshall struggled to control his delegation and he was forced to admit, quote-unquote, internal differences in a statement to the Singapore press. Meanwhile, the delegation was not helped by the British press, whose reports characterised Singapore as an island rife with disloyalty and subversion and teetering on the brink of chaos. Towards the end of the talks, Lennox Boyd conceded to Marshall's proposals on citizenship. This was welcome news for the Chinese community, who would now be enfranchised. Celebrations were, however, muted due to increasing pessimism. The divisions in the delegation were making progress on the issue of self-determination unlikely. And as if on cue, Lim Chun Mong, the Liberal Socialist Party representative, promptly released a statement in Singapore claiming credit on the citizenship issue for the Liberal Socialist Party, and for that he was excoriated in the Chinese press. The Zhongxing Jipao wrote gloomily, quote, "The most pressing problem at the moment is not the views of Britain, but the unity of the delegation," unquote. The Sinchu Jitpo published an insightful editorial which summed up the essential difference between Lennox Boyd and Marshall. Lennox Boyd saw Singapore as a colony. It was of Britain's creation, and it could give it away at any time of its own choosing. Marshall saw Singapore as a protectorate. The British were foreigners whose presence in Singapore was at the invitation of Singaporeans. The time was due for them to leave, and if they did not, then they were no longer protectors, but occupiers. And this difference, this fundamental difference in view, could not be easily bridged. So, to no one's surprise, the talks broke down shortly after. Marshall had made a final offer that the British and Singaporeans both have three representatives on the Defence and Security Council, and the chairman to be a Malayan appointed by the Federation. Lennox Boyd, not wanting the three British members to be outvoted, insisted on the High Commissioner being the chairman and holding the casting vote. The delegation was divided on whether to accept this. Marshall and Lim Chin Siong argued that there was no difference between partial self-government and the lack of self-government. As long as the British held the final say, systemic imperialism and discrimination would continue unchecked. The rest of the delegation wanted to take what they could now and come back later. Marshall, the good Democrat, offered to abide by the majority decision, sign the document, return home and resign. However, Lee Kuan Yew, not wanting to appear less left-wing and anti-colonial than Marshall, then changed his vote to no, and everyone else, also not wanting to appear less left-wing and anti-colonial, followed suit. So the delegation voted unanimously to reject the British plan, except the Liberal Socialists who abstained. On 15th May, the Constitutional Conference officially broke down, and Marshall bitterly described Lennox Boyd's final offer as, quote, "Christmas pudding with arsenic sauce," unquote. The English language press in Singapore and London, of course, called for Marshall to resign, but the vernacular press backed Marshall. The breakdown of talks was blamed on the British, their selfish concerns and their insistence on control of internal security. The Nanyang Shangpao, for example, asked, quote, "What sort of government would we have if we are not given the power to control our own internal security?" Unquote. It noted how the British press had been biased against self-government for Singapore. It bluntly accused the British of prioritising its capitalist interests over Malaya's fears of communism. British intransigence was due to its desire to protect its investments, property and capital in Singapore. If Britain was really concerned about communism, it would not have recognised the People's Republic of China so quickly. And it would take away the communists' biggest propaganda weapon by giving Singapore self-government. The Nanyang Shangpao angrily declared, quote, "The so-called protection of strategic bases is nothing but a diplomatic language," unquote. The disunity of the delegation was also blamed for undermining Marshall. Delegates had declared unity but attacked each other behind the scene. For something as important as independence, differences should have been put aside. Some, a minority, blamed Marshall's negotiating technique and leadership style, but not his principles, of course. The Chinese community urged Marshall to stay in office and continue the fight for independence. The Nanyang Shangpao called Marshall, quote, an indomitable fighter for Singapore's cause of self-government and independence, unquote. The Nanfang Evening Post hoped he would not resign, twice referring to him as, quote, a fighter who will never say die, unquote, and asking him not to be overly emotional. The Chongqing Jitbao, noting that the pro-British Straits Times and the London Press were demanding that Marshall resign, argued that his resignation would play into the hands of colonialists, as they wanted a weaker, less principled leader who would cooperate with the British. Letters to the press urged him not to resign, praising his uncompromising stand with the British, devotion to the cause and work ethic. In Marshall's final assembly session as chief minister, he proposed a motion for the assembly to approve the stand that the delegation had taken in London. The Liberal Socialist Party, however, opposed the motion, pinning the blame on Marshall. Lim Chun Mong proposed an amendment that the delegation should have accepted the British offer. The Labour Front and PAP both defended Marshall, and angry attacks and recriminations flew. You can read the whole thing. It's all online as part of the Singapore Hansard. Assemblyman Lim Cher King spoke bluntly, revealing that, quote, filthy party politics and party manoeuvres created disunity in the delegation, unquote. And he read from the delegation's internal minutes to illustrate how it had been undermined, in particular by Lee Kuan Yew. Lee spent more time in meetings with British politicians, lobbying for support, and seeking to build friendships and alliances than he did meeting with his own delegation. Lee clearly had his own agenda, which was to promote himself to the British as a viable future collaborator and to dispel any idea that he was a tool of the communists. Lim Cher King declared that he was sick of party politics and he resigned from the Liberal Socialist Party to sit as an independent. The Liberal Socialist Party's amendment was subsequently defeated and Marshall's motion carried. Marshall himself was reluctant to resign, but his party's executive committee voted to push him out. His inability to suppress the infighting within his own party over the previous year, as well as his poor leadership of the conference delegation, had now caught up with him. Even at this late stage, Marshall believed his cabinet would resign with him, but none wanted to give up the perks of office. Even before they left London, they had already decided Lim Yew Hock would succeed Marshall. On the 7th of June, Marshall tendered his resignation. The Chinese community reacted with sadness and regret. Letters and editorials praised his principles. The Hsinchu Jitpo called his resignation, quote-unquote, glorious, and worried that his successor would not be able to fill his shoes. The Nanfang Evening Post declared that Marshall exemplified Confucius. Dao Bu Xing, Cheng Fu Fu Yu Hai. If the way is not possible, I will get on a raft and float out to sea. What does it mean to be a leader? In the beginning of episode 26, I argued that Marshall was the greatest of Singapore's five locally elected leaders. In just 14 months in office, he single-handedly transformed the face of Singapore politics. Through sheer force of his personality, rhetoric, and ideas, he awakened the people of Singapore to politics, to the meaning of nationalism and self-government. He seized the initiative in the decolonization process from the British, who were ill-prepared for a man of such talent, conviction, and pride. The British wanted men like Tunku Abdul Rahman or Sir John Kotilawala of Ceylon. Conservative, cautious men who would work cooperatively with the British establishment. They did not expect an uncompromising man of principle and conviction who would simply refuse to concede a point if he felt it was immoral. They did not expect a man who would act against his own self-interest if he felt it would not benefit his country. And you might ask, well, what if they had gotten the man they wanted? What happened if the British got a man who was cooperative and cautious, who was pragmatic and acted in his own self-interest, a consummate politician, an experienced politician of his own power base? Well, that's what happened next. David Marshall was succeeded by Lim Yew Hock, who was, at the time, one of Singapore's most experienced politicians, with a firm power base of the Singapore Trades Union Congress behind him. And the Lim Yew Hock administration was, let's be blunt, a disaster for Singapore and for Singapore's anti-colonial movement. He colluded in the repression of his own countrymen. He broke the back of our anti-colonial movement. He made the economy worse. He was in the pocket of both the British and the Americans. He may even have been heavily corrupt. I'll talk about this next week. Or what if Marshall had accepted the British deal and worked with the Internal Security Council? And again, we know, we can see what would have happened, because the 1959 Constitution was very, very similar to what was proposed by Lennox Boyd in 56 and rejected by Marshall as inadequate. And the man who inherited the 1959 Constitution, Lee Kuan Yew, would use the Security Council as cover to detain his political opponents without trial while blaming it on the British and Federation governments. If Marshall had seized that same opportunity, he would have been stronger, more powerful with the Internal Security Council by collaborating with the British. But he rejected it because it was wrong. It was dishonest. It offended him because he was a strong believer in justice, and it offended his belief in the importance of a sound constitutional framework as a basis for good democratic governance. So we are lucky, we are very, very lucky that David Marshall, and not any other politician of 1955, was our first Chief Minister. David Marshall set a standard of leadership, of morality, of service to the people that no other leader of Singapore has ever come close to matching. But because he was there to set that expectation, all of them since have been forced to pay lip service to the ideal. Imagine if the first chief minister had been someone venial and corrupt and easily pushed around by the British. Marshall showed us that we can expect better, that we should expect better, that we can have better than mere collaborators and self-serving politicians. For those of you who feel that the subsequent governments since independence have behaved in an arrogant or self-interested manner, just imagine how much worse it would have been if we had not had David Marshall first. It would fall to another leader of Singapore to win us political emancipation, but it was David Marshall who won us spiritual emancipation, by giving us pride and hope and conviction and courage that we could win independence. He made us believe. Before him, we did not believe we could win independence. After just a few months of David Marshall, we believed. We believed that we could win freedom. Not in 10 years, not in 5 years, and not through some sketchy merger that reduced our rights, but straightforward independence right now. And not because some people, some white people in London felt that we were ready, but because we deserve it, because we are human beings who are worthy of respect and dignity, because we have the right to be free. We did not believe that until David Marshall came along. David Marshall did that for us. No other leader of Singapore has ever come close to treating Singaporeans like people instead of subjects and economic digits. No other leader of Singapore has embodied service the way David Marshall did. No other leader of Singapore has ever suffered for us as much as David Marshall did. And he did this in spite of all his flaws. And he did this not to make himself better, but to make us better, to make his people better, to make his country better. That is the measure of greatness. And that is why David Marshall is our greatest leader. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thanks very much. See you next week.